It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, from the campaign to the Oval Office, we'll get the latest in national politics with Harry Enten from 538.com.
First, for residents of rural Wisconsin, it appears that it may be getting more difficult to find a lawyer. According to the State Bar of Wisconsin, fewer than 40% of the state's active attorneys are practicing law outside of major urban areas.
In addition, 15 counties have 10 or fewer attorneys actively practicing law, including a handful of counties in northern Wisconsin. Many of these attorneys are approaching retirement age, and there may not be young lawyers lining up to take their places.
WPR's Danielle Kading joins us now. She's our reporter based in Superior and recently reported on the lawyer shortage in rural Wisconsin. Danny, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks, Veronica.
So, Danny, according to your piece, many rural Wisconsin counties are facing a shortage of lawyers. How concerning is that?
Well, according to Amy Ferguson with the association's new lawyer challenges committee, it's an access to justice issue. They're worried that some people are not going to be able to find an attorney when they need one. And sometimes we're seeing cases where out-of-state attorneys are assisting in counties when there's one that can't be found.
And it seems like this is an issue that's striking northern Wisconsin particularly hard. How acute is this this problem in northern Wisconsin?
Well, in northern Wisconsin, you know, there are 9 counties out of 15 that have 10 or fewer attorneys. And so, you know, that means that there are just a handful of people to cover often large geographic areas. And so when you consider that, but then there's also lower populations. So I think people kind of tend to assume that, you know, if there's fewer people, there's fewer problems. But that really isn't the case. They're seeing issues, you know, with family law, divorce, and drug cases. You know, it really runs the gamut.
So is this a problem that's already come home to roost, so to speak? Have you heard from people who say they have been having a difficult time finding legal representation in northern Wisconsin?
You know, I haven't heard that myself. The things that I have heard are that in some cases they're searching far and wide for public defenders. It's pretty common practice for private practice attorneys to be asked to take on cases by the state public defender's office. You know, whether or not they're not able to access an attorney, I think, you know, it's the timeline, right? I mean, based on the caseload and how many are coming in, there just might not be enough attorneys to meet the number of cases that they're being faced with.
And a looming crop of retirements, it sounds like, is making this problem more difficult. What are we expecting in terms of retirement of lawyers in rural parts of the state?
Well, statewide, if you look at all of the attorneys in the state, there's about 17,000. Not all of them are actively practicing. But of that roughly 17,000 number, 53% are 50 or older. And that's pretty much par for the course across the state. I mean, when you look county by county at the numbers, the majority of them are seeing that trend. They're either at that halfway point or higher in some cases. Really, the counties that have younger attorneys are counties like Milwaukee and Dane counties, the more urban areas. I mean, 63-64% of active attorneys in Wisconsin practice in 3 counties, Waukesha, Milwaukee, and Dane counties.
We're talking with WPR reporter in Superior, Danielle Kading, right now. She's talking about a lawyer shortage in rural parts of Wisconsin. And Danny, if you're a lawyer and you're practicing in these rural areas in Wisconsin, do you get paid less than if you're practicing in one of those big 3 metro areas?
You know, I think that's the perception among young law students or young attorneys, that if you move to a rural area, you're going to make less money. It's going to be more difficult to make a go of it. And, you know, in some cases that may be true, but I'm also hearing from judges and lawyers that you can make a very good living, you know, because of the need for attorneys up north or in rural areas, that you can set up a private practice for less than it cost, you know, say 30 years ago, because of advancements and things like the internet. There's less overhead. I think, you know, one of the challenges that they're seeing is that younger people, they like to be where things are happening, you know, and that's usually in larger cities. And so it kind of depends on the individual and what their tastes are. And, you know, it also depends on their families, too. It's like if you're a young lawyer and you have a spouse, you're going to consider whether or not they can find a job in rural or northern Wisconsin and how easy is it for them to make a living, you know, based on two incomes.
So it sounds like there's some perception hurdles in getting younger lawyers attracted to these rural areas. Are there any efforts to be an ambassador for rural Wisconsin and northern Wisconsin to get young attorneys into these areas?
Yeah, well, the State Bar has organized a bus tour that they're going to be setting out on, I believe it's the weekend of October 7th and 8th. They're asking young law students and lawyers and their families to sign up before September 9th. If they would be interested in that, they're going to take them on a tour of rural areas or northern areas of the state like Rhinelander and Marinette to kind of showcase, you know, the communities that they could possibly serve in, what opportunities might be available, and, you know, what are some of the benefits of being outside of the city, you know, maybe less competition with your peers, that is easier to find a job for one, or maybe it's just quality of life. You're not as stressed out. You're not working those late hours.
What role might student debt play in this whole picture about attracting young lawyers to rural parts of Wisconsin?
Well, according to one judge up north, Vilas County Circuit Court Judge Chip Nielsen, he says that it's a big consideration because a lot of these young lawyers are coming out of law school with debt ranging anywhere from $80,000 to more than $120,000 a year, or I'm sorry, not a year, but over the term of going to law school. You know, a lot of them are $20,000 a year schools, and so, you know, it's a lot when you consider that the starting pay is probably a lot less than that.
Now, you also touched on a Nebraska model that the state is offering student debt relief to those young lawyers who commit there. Is there any plan for Wisconsin to think about doing something like that if this problem continues to pick up steam?
You know, as far as I know, I'm not in any kind of position to comment on that. I do know that there's been discussion related to student debt or student loan debt relief to get people to move to rural areas in general. That was something I believe Senator Lassa had supported in the last session, but it really hasn't gone anywhere. And whether or not that a similar proposal would be introduced specifically to attract lawyers to rural areas or northern Wisconsin remains to be seen.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica.
That was Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll find out how Wisconsin became the worst state in the nation for black incarceration.
Right now, we're 75 days away from the November general election when people head to the polls to cast their ballot for Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton, Republican nominee Donald Trump, or a third party candidate.
While polls put Clinton in the lead against Trump, she doesn't necessarily have a lock on the election. But both candidates are struggling to appeal to younger voters, and more conservative leaning states are having more competitive races, maybe due to Trump's candidacy.
Joining us now with the latest in national politics is Harry Enten. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back. Well, let's start off with the latest polling numbers. Where do the candidates stand right now, national and maybe key states, too?
Sure. I mean, look, it's basically the same story. There has been some tightening in some national polls, although, you know, it kind of differs. You look at one poll, it shows one thing. You look at another poll, it shows another. Our 538 polling average right now, our projection of where the popular vote will end up on Election Day is about a 7-point win for Hillary Clinton. And that's in large part because of her leads in a number of swing states where we have a lot of polling. So, for instance, in Florida and Ohio, she has clear leads, 4 to 5 percentage points. And if you look just across the board, you just see a whole bunch of leads for Hillary Clinton, so that if you add up all of the state polls and you weight them by population, you get to Hillary Clinton having a lead of about 7.5 points. And historically speaking, that's actually been a more accurate way of projecting the national vote than just looking at the national polls.
after the convention, Hillary Clinton had a big jump. The question then was, okay, is this just a temporary post-convention bounce? It seems like the bounce has stayed up pretty high.
It stayed very high. I mean, look, there hasn't been any clear evidence to me that there has been much of a receding of that bounce. When you just look at the favorable ratings for Hillary Clinton, for instance, in Gallup, which tracks it daily, you see that, in fact, she is basically staying in the low 40s, which isn't great, but Donald Trump is stuck in the low 30s, which is far worse. So to me, if you just look at it, there really hasn't been much. That bounce is more, not even just a bounce, it's a new plateau, you might say.
That said, you wrote a piece along the lines of Hillary Clinton hasn't won yet. Democrats, don't get too comfortable here. There is still time for things to change. What are you looking at?
I think, if you just look historically where things are at this point in the campaign and where they've ended up, there have been some campaigns where things do change. 1976 is an example, 1980 is another example. Even in 1996, the polls ended up being way too generous to Bill Clinton at this point from where the eventual margin ended up. That said, people who are ahead at this point usually win. Hillary Clinton's got a good lead, but it's not a lead that guarantees her a win. It just means she'll probably win about 90% of the time or 85 to 90% of the time.
Is there a case to be made that Donald Trump has not yet begun to fight? We're just now seeing ads starting to be run by the Trump campaign and the Republican National Party?
Well, I mean, what type of campaign is he running then? This is just like the funniest thing in the world, right? Look, he's been the general election, the Republican nominee since early May, and all of a sudden now he's just starting to fight? One of the things that I think is very clear from the polls, if you look at the different states, is yes, Hillary Clinton is leading in the swing states. But even if you look at the states outside of the swing states, states where Hillary Clinton hasn't shown any ads at all, and you aggregate those together, they point to the same margin of victory for Hillary Clinton as do those swing state polls. That is, she is comfortably ahead. And while I have no doubt that the swing state polls reflect Hillary Clinton's large advertising edge, Donald Trump has a lot of ground to make up in these swing states, and I'm just not sure that even just coming in at the last moment like this, even if he closes a little, would be enough.
Do we have an idea that at this point in the race, a large percentage of the population has made up its mind, it knows who it's going to vote for?
Yes. I mean, look, most people know who they're going to vote for before they even hear the candidates, right? Because most people vote along party ID. But that being said, we do know that a majority of voters at this point hold a very unfavorable view of Donald Trump. I think the average in the three most recent national polls that look at, how many people have a very unfavorable view of Donald Trump, I think it's like something along the lines of 52%. That's a very, very high hill to climb, because that essentially means he has to win everybody else or start winning people who really, really hate him. And most voters at this point say they're not willing to vote for Donald Trump. Could he win? Of course he could win. We can't dismiss anything. But if you just look at the different metrics across the way, it just is a very, very tough hill for him to climb.
You wrote another piece on 538.com about Donald Trump's impact on the electoral map, if any. And we've heard the case from Donald Trump himself saying, hey, I'm going to bring states into play, usually Democratic states. I'm going to bring them into play, have a shot at winning them. Some analysts said, well, Donald Trump, none of us predicted what happened in the primary. Maybe he could shake things up like that. When you look at what's happening in the polling in states around the country, battleground or not, what are you seeing? Is there a Donald Trump shakeup effect here?
Well, if you look, most of the states that were the swing states last time around are still the swing states this time around. There's not much of a difference of what's going on in terms of where the states are lining up. The difference, the key difference, what we're seeing is there's much more of a compression. That is, the states that may have gone for Barack Obama by 15 percentage points are still going Democratic, say a state like Maine, but instead it's going for Hillary Clinton by 10. If you look at a state like South Carolina, that went for Mitt Romney by 9, 10 percentage points in 2012. This time around is going for Donald Trump, but only by 2 percentage points. So we do see pretty much the same states are red that were red and the same states that were blue, but we do see some tightening margins.
Let me throw a hypothesis at you there. Maybe that means that on both sides there's less enthusiasm for the candidate, less enthusiasm among Republicans for Donald Trump in those red states, less enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton among Democrats in those blue states?
I think that there's some of that that's going on. I think that's sure. But I think what's also going on is there's been a little bit of an upsetting of the apple cart in terms of what the coalitions are exactly are. So I think that Donald Trump is doing much better among white voters without a college degree in the North, while Hillary Clinton's doing much better among white voters with a college degree in the South. So that allows those margins to tighten up. And so I think not everything is going along the same partisan ID lines, although I will say that certainly for Donald Trump there is less enthusiasm than there was for Mitt Romney 4 years ago, and I think that's a lot of the reason why you see so many undecided voters in a state like South Carolina, where right now the race is close to being pretty even.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com about the latest in national politics and the presidential race. One group that is not very enthusiastic in this election, according to polling you've looked at, Harry, younger voters. What's happening?
Well, essentially what we see is that Hillary Clinton is leading with younger voters, but with 40% of the vote. That's significantly lower than Barack Obama last time around, who got about 60% of voters under the age of 30. Does that mean Donald Trump is doing any better than Mitt Romney? No. In fact, what we see is Donald Trump is probably going to get the lowest percentage of voters under the age of 30, at least since we have records going back to 1952. What's going on instead is that these younger voters are either saying they're undecided, or both Jill Stein and Gary Johnson are getting greater than 10% of the vote among those voters 18 to 29, which to me is fascinating, because you would think, and Democrats have argued for a long time, that as the younger part of the electorate becomes more diverse, it would be good for them. But in fact, that's not happening at all. These younger voters are seeming to say, you know what, screw both major parties. We're going to look for a third-party option.
Is some of that the Bernie Sanders voters we've been wondering about for so long? Harry saying, we're younger voters. We like Bernie Sanders. We don't like what happened there. We're looking elsewhere.
It could be that, of course. It could be maybe have the relationship inverse there. Instead, people were going for Bernie Sanders because he was independent, and instead of saying now they're not going for Hillary Clinton because they don't like what she did to Bernie Sanders. In fact, they may have gone to Bernie Sanders in the first place because they wanted a more independent type of candidate. And so, you know, it's a tough thing to exactly figure out. But what we do know right now is that both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have their hands full with younger voters.
I wonder if this is a problem for the parties, for partisan politics, or if this is just the unique nature of the two candidates running, with both with high negative ratings, particularly in the case of Donald Trump.
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it? Is this election merely just a dot on the long sort of road ahead, and then 2 years and 4 years from now, everything else is going to remain the same? Or is it the case that this is a turning point, and maybe what we had thought of becoming an increasingly polarized electorate will not be the case as we go forward, as younger voters say, you know what, we're not going to vote along the same lines as everybody else, and things are changed? I don't know the answer to that, and I have learned this election cycle not to try and make predictions too far into the future, let alone years from now.
A chat you had at 538, you and the gang there, looked at the Hillary Clinton candidacy and trying to answer the question, is she good? Is she a good politician? That's why she's winning? Or is she lucky? What were some of the things you were weighing back and forth? And a lot of the people seem to say a little of both.
I think the things that you're weighing back and forth is, look, Hillary Clinton has a 40% favorable rating, and yet she's winning this election when no one else in her position has ever won an election before, at least that we have on record, at least presidential elections, because Donald Trump is so disliked. So that would suggest she might be lucky, or the fact that her only opponent in the Democratic Party was Bernie Sanders, who, while a lot of voters may have liked him, really, you know, was a socialist and was always going to have a difficult time connecting with the middle of the Democratic Party. However, at the same time, look at Hillary Clinton's electoral record. The only elections he's ever lost was to Barack Obama, and she actually got more votes in that primary than he did, and Barack Obama is arguably the greatest politician of this era. At the same time, she was able to ensure that no one else ran against her in the Democratic primary because she got so many endorsements so early on. And then finally, I just point out, look, Donald Trump faced off against 16 other Republicans, and they all lost. They all lost to him. And Hillary Clinton, for better or worse, is crushing him right now. So to me, I think it's a little bit of both.
It all raises an interesting alternate history. What would Hillary Clinton's campaign be looking like if it was one of those other 16 candidates, or maybe 14 or 15 of them? Ben Carson might have been a different situation.
I always was looking forward to the matchup between Hillary Clinton and Bobby Jindal. I don't know about you, but Look, if she had faced off against John Kasich, my guess is this race would be closer. I don't think Kasich would necessarily be leading, as some of the hypothetical polls indicated, but I do have to think that the race would have been closer for no other reason than it probably would have been more of a generic Democrat versus a generic Republican, and right now the economy is doing okay but not great, and that would indicate a much closer race than the polls right now do.
Hey, Harry, I saw you tweeted, you retweeted somebody else's rating of a bunch of Senate races around the country, a hot contested Senate races people are keeping an eye on. Wisconsin's wasn't one of them. What do you make of that?
Knew it wasn't, and the reason it wasn't was because Russ Feingold is so far ahead in the polls right now. You know, you look at that Marquette poll, there'll be another one in another week. My dear friend Charles Franklin, who may be listening right now. Hello, Charles. If in fact, we continue to show polls where Russ Feingold has a high single-digit or perhaps even a low double-digit lead, that's by far one of the largest leads of any of the races that are out there, and certainly the largest lead a Democrat holds over a currently held Republican seat.
I wanted to ask, I hear you had a run-in of sorts with former congressman, disgraced, and then New York mayoral candidate Anthony Weiner. What happened?
Let's just say Anthony and I, we got together. No, I was doing a little television shoot in New York, and he knew that I had gotten a new cell phone because I think he listens to the podcast that we do, the 538 Politics podcast, and he asked me to look at it because he knew that my old phone was this sort of unique phone, and he took a look, and he said, nice new phone, but it seems a little bit much to me. Granted, I must admit that I'm not sure I'd necessarily take cell phone advice from Anthony Weiner, given his history.
Right, or lend him one's own phone.
I think as long as I saw it when it was within my sights, that was okay. I just didn't want him to take it to some place where I couldn't see him.
Well, that's a good policy, Harry. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten. He's a senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. He joins us every week at this time to give us the latest in national politics and, of course, the ongoing presidential election campaign.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out how Wisconsin became the worst state in the nation for black incarceration and what, if anything, can be done about it. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to an AP reporter who broke the story on Clinton Foundation donors and their access to Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State.
Yesterday, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett rescinded a curfew for people under the age of 18 that he put into place during unrest following the shooting death of Sylville Smith by a police officer. That shooting led to unrest in the Sherman Park neighborhood. Here's Mayor Barrett reacting to the upheaval last Saturday evening.
Last night was unlike anything I have seen in my adult life in this city. I hope I never see it again. For every member of this police department, it was unlike anything that they had seen in their career. For every member of the fire department, it was unlike anything they had seen in their entire career.
One big issue that's been talked about in the days following the protests is the high rate of incarceration of black men in Milwaukee and in the state overall. According to the 2010 census, Wisconsin had the highest incarceration rate of black males nationwide, 12.8%. That's as opposed to a national average of 6.7%. A CityLab article even goes so far as to call Wisconsin the home of black incarceration. But how did we get to this point?
Joining us now is Pam Oliver. She's a professor of sociology at UW-Madison. Among other things, she studies racial disparities and criminal justice. Pam, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
So, Pam, we mentioned some of those 2010 census numbers there, but those are, you know, about 6 years old now. Where do things stand today?
Well, I'm trying to figure that out, actually. I just got some new data in the last couple of months. Now that I'm done being chair, I'm about ready to dig into the data. It looks like we're still the highest in the nation, as far as I can tell. I don't look at census data. I look at a program called the National Corrections Reporting Program, which tracks prison admissions and records of people in prison. And it appears from those data on my preliminary analysis that prison admissions and incarceration has been declining in Wisconsin. But when I run the scatter plots, we're still number one. It appears it must be declining everywhere else as well.
And I'd like to hear from you, a sociologist who studies these things, what this problem looks like when it comes to the racial disparities.
Well, Wisconsin is extremely high, and I don't have, like, the latest number for you. When I was running these numbers in the early 2000s, our racial disparity was about 20 to 1. I think it's actually still up there, but it could have gone down somewhat. We're still the nation's highest. So what that means is black people are 20 times more likely to be, I should say, in state prison. So that census number is actually would include people in jail as well as in prison. There's also federal prison, and the big thing that I really look at is state prison. So there's these different ways of being incarcerated.
Now, we tend to think of the big cities centers in Wisconsin as being sort of at the epicenter of this, Milwaukee and Madison. But is this a problem that goes beyond that? Is this a state issue?
So, yes, it is. It's a complicated issue. About three quarters of Wisconsin's black people live in Milwaukee County, and most of the rest live in Dane, Racine, and Kenosha counties, a little bit in Rock and Waukesha. So not, or actually they don't live in Waukesha, they just get sent to prison from Waukesha. But so by numbers, most of it is Milwaukee and southern Wisconsin. But if you look at the incarceration rates, the black incarceration rate for the rest of the state is actually higher. So Milwaukee actually has a lower black incarceration rate than the average of the rest of the state. And that's not to say that Milwaukee's is low. It's actually extremely high. It's just that the rest of the state has these extremely high disparities as well. So raw numbers, it's mostly Milwaukee and then a couple of other counties, including Dane. Dane's disparity is much higher than Milwaukee's disparity, and the rest of the state has very high disparities.
Milwaukee has been struggling in particular with data like you're talking about, being at the top of some of these racial inequity sorts of measures. And the 2013 Race to Equity report by the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families also describes Dane County as having some of the widest black-white inequalities in terms of education and unemployment and poverty. How do those broader societal things play into the issues of things like structural inequality and incarceration in Wisconsin?
Well, obviously, they play a huge role. And Wisconsin has extremely high economic disparities. And again, as you alluded to, Dane County has extraordinarily high economic and educational disparities, even compared to much of the rest of Wisconsin. What's interesting, and this, my statement is based on an analysis I did of older data, not of the most recent data, which I'm hoping to go back to and do, but what I found when I was doing the analysis in the past is that it wasn't absolute poverty levels that predicted black incarceration. It was relative poverty levels. So places where both whites and blacks are poor have lower incarceration rates than places like Dane County in particular and Wisconsin more generally, in which white people in general are pretty well off. But there's this very high disparity between blacks and whites. And so that points to not just, there's a tendency to think that the problem is, why are these poor people doing things that get them into trouble? But the other side of it is, what's going on in the criminal justice system and the social control actions? And I think those disparities are pointing to how the social control system behaves. It's like trying to sort of box in low-income black people.
What are you talking about when you use the term social control system?
Well, that is the technical term for the criminal justice system. Its job is part of the broader keeping people in line, is what people mean by social control. When you talk in social theory, you make the point that the formal system of punishing people is just one part of a broader system of social control, and that the rest of social control is the informal social controls. And for example, there's a big debate in criminology, an argument that too much formal social control actually hurts informal social control and ultimately reduces the ability to control crime, because the main reason people don't control crime, don't commit crimes, is if they're socially well integrated.
We're talking right now with Pam Oliver, UW-Madison professor, who studies racial disparities and criminal justice, looking at why Wisconsin has the highest levels of black incarceration in the nation and some of the broader issues that surround that. And we'll take a phone call now and go to Mike joining us in Platteville. Mike, hello.
Hi. Insider's perspective, I'm retired law enforcement. I've lived in southeastern Wisconsin for 30 years, and I'm very familiar with the Milwaukee Police Department. Tom Barrett is no Bobby Kennedy. The police union, in my opinion, protects the bottom feeders, the good cops, the ones who are professional, who have human people skills, are so distraught they're leaving the department. And unless Tom Barrett gets a backbone and stands up to the Milwaukee Police Union and says, we're going to screen out the officers who should not be in law enforcement, this problem will continue. And Mayor Flynn, or not Mayor Flynn, Chief Flynn was surprised that the, I'm surprised there weren't riots in the streets years ago. With what's happening in Milwaukee, the white male conservative structure, I don't justify violence, but I understand why it exists. And unless Mayor Barrett gets a backbone and gets rid of the bottom feeding cops in the police union, this problem will get worse.
Mike, thank you for that perspective. And Pam, what do you say to that? Mike hinting at maybe structural problems, maybe structural racism within the police department, and putting the blame there on Mayor Barrett.
Well, I'm not going to talk about who's to blame in terms of the mayor or the police or whatever, but it's definitely two things to say. One is that organizations... The default of an organization is to defend itself. And so actually all organizations have the problem of tending to defend their bad performers. And that is a problem in the police is, I think, something that people have been talking about a lot. The other problem is also, though, looking at what the police are structurally being asked to do. So in a city like Milwaukee, the police job is to enforce segregation. And in many parts of the United States, the job the police have been given is to enforce segregation boundaries and keep the lid on black poverty. And that puts them, even when they are, many police officers think of themselves as kind of having a social work motivation. Even when they have that kind of motivation, they find themselves being asked to do a job that basically... requires them in a way to oppress people.
Well, what do you mean by enforced segregation? I think probably if you spoke to the officers, they would not say that's on their list of duties. So what do you mean by that?
Well, this is one of the subtle parts of policing. And again, it's done differently in different places. But one of the things police are taught to look for is somebody who's out of place. And one of the ways of being out of place is being the wrong race in a place. And so when you're in a highly segregated area, the nature of police training is often to look out for, why is this dark-faced person in this predominantly white area? That problem is actually more acute in suburban police departments than typically in inner-city police departments. But that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And again, it's subtle, and it's really important to understand that jurisdictions vary a lot in terms of exactly what they're doing, but that's one of the general problems.
Pam Oliver is with us right now. She's a UW-Madison professor who studies racial disparities in criminal justice, and we're looking at why Wisconsin has one of the highest levels of black incarceration in the nation.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this as a big problem facing the state? Have you or any of your family members been impacted by things like mandatory minimums, truth in sentencing laws? What, if anything, can be done to reduce the incarceration in Wisconsin, which, as we're hearing, overall is on the decline, and especially these racial disparities, which remains high in Wisconsin? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Pam Oliver, professor of sociology at UW-Madison. She studies, among other things, racial disparities in criminal justice, talking about how Wisconsin came to be a leader in rates of incarceration of black men.
And we're taking your calls right now. How has this topic affected you, and what solutions would you like to see? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take another caller now. We've got Pat with us next in Richland Center. Hi, Pat.
Hey, good afternoon, and another great show.
Thank you.
You know, I live out here not too far from Boscobel Supermax, and they have every week job openings, $13 an hour to start. Now, that isn't even that isn't even an entry-level pay, hardly. I mean, so here we've got the bottom of the economic ladder here, being incarcerated by their poverty-stricken neighbors out here. And I mean, you can go to Richland Center and get a job at the dairies for like $17 an hour start. And what's going to happen here, 6 years out of Governor Divide and Conquer, some of these chickens coming home to roost. When you put low-skilled guards, $13 an hour, that's all you're going to get, the state is going to have so many lawsuits because it is just... Well, treating us all like we are just so unimportant.
Pat, thank you for that that thought and sharing that with us. And Pat, talking about poverty reaching beyond those who are incarcerated and the poverty maybe in rural areas of the state and the need to fill economic roles there for jobs. What do you see about the connections he's getting at?
Well, one of the ironies that was certainly part of fueling the prison boom when things were booming in the late 90s and the early 2000s, prisons were being sold to poor white communities as job programs for whites. So we definitely did have the irony that in this state and in many states, urban black people were being locked up and shipped off to rural white communities as a job program for whites. So that is one of the sad things that actually has been happening.
Well, thank you for that call. And I want to talk now about what all of this means, the incarceration rates, Wisconsin, Milwaukee being the highest in the nation for black men, what this does to impact the community. We've heard a couple people say, well, one on the show today that's surprised these sorts of riots in Sherman Park haven't happened sooner. Other people saying, you know, there are children growing up without fathers, a generation. What impacts do you see as a sociologist?
Well, there's a growing sociological literature that is talking about the harm being done by mass incarceration. One could fairly say the sociologists have been sort of slow to pick up the baton, but it is now picked up. It's a booming research area. And there's lots of evidence that children who come up in families where the parents have been incarcerated have disrupted lives. There's evidence that women's poverty is related to pulling men out of communities. There is a tangle of pathology that's basically caused by the criminal justice system impacting the stratification system.
And what might be the impacts on future generations, children who grow up without maybe a missing male generation?
It's not just that, the grief and you know, families spend extra money to have their family member in prison. There's extortionary prices at commissaries and telephones. It costs a lot of money to go visit them. So children often experience grief from an absent parent. They end up in foster care, or they end up being shunted around among relatives. They have parent, or if they're left behind with a single mother, that mother's likely to be experiencing psychological distress, reduced income. You know, I used to say as a kind of shorthand that many of the children who are experiencing and even causing the most problems in the schools are precisely the children who've been damaged by parental incarceration and incarceration in their communities. So it is devastating. And it cycles back into ongoing poverty because there is a stigma. If somebody has a criminal record, particularly if they're black, it's very hard for them to get a job. And so that becomes an... they can't get, once they're stigmatized, it's hard for them to get a legitimate job. Even, I mean, most people exit prison wanting to go straight and wanting to build a life that doesn't involve crime, but then they face all this job discrimination.
Pam Oliver is with us right now, sociologist at UW-Madison, and we're talking right now about Milwaukee and Wisconsin's position as the worst place in the country for black male incarceration. And Pam, when we talk about this issue, we often look back to truth in sentencing bills, which is something that wasn't unique to Wisconsin, but seems to have a particularly big impact here. Tell us about the influence there.
Well, I actually was just I've analyzed the 1990s data a lot, so this is probably going to surprise you. But the big thing that sent a lot of black people to prison was the drug war. Truth in sentencing also impacted mass incarceration. But there's actually a rise in white incarceration after truth in sentencing. So a lot of the impact of truth in sentencing nationally was actually to reduce the disparity. And even so, paradoxically, you know, the disparity is whites are in the denominator. And so some of these forces that led to an expansion of incarceration overall locked up more white people and then reduced the disparity. So truth in sentencing hit black people very heavily. I'm not saying it didn't. But it was more of an equal opportunity mass incarceration variable. It's really the drug war that really stood out as this, to most of us, to many of us, a very unfair policy, because whites and blacks have comparable rates of using illegal substances, and yet there's these massive racial disparities. You know, at one point when I was calculating the numbers, the racial disparity in drug sentences was 60-1. Black to white, and there's that just is nowhere near what the usage rates are.
So what happened during the war on drugs that made it such a ripe time for these racial disparities to increase?
So now we're talking, you know, archaeology. This is the late 80s and the early 90s. Highly racialized focus on crack cocaine, what we sociologists call, a panic. A media panic where people just sort of made up, like, crack baby. You know, there's this whole media panic about crack babies, which turned out, no, that didn't actually happen. So you get, it's focused in big cities. It's focused primarily in urban black areas. It's focused, the whole policies are really focusing on black people. And so you look at those numbers in the big cities. Wisconsin was a little slow into that game. It actually accelerated its incarceration of black people more in the 90s in Milwaukee.
Well, as you talk about there, the war on drugs was not something that was unique to Wisconsin. This was a national movement. So why are we still feeling, it seems like, the effects of this and also truth in sentencing more severely than other parts of the nation? We're at the top of that list, and even though rates are declining, we're still number one in that.
Well, it's so, and that's, again, the detailed answer to that is something that takes detailed analysis, and that's one of the things I'm hoping to do. But other states, like New York, started declining in its incarceration rates in 1992. Other states started declining earlier, and so part of the reason Wisconsin went to the top of the pack is some of the other states that had been really high started reducing their rates. And Wisconsin kept going up. And so then it's like, well, why did Wisconsin keep going up when in other parts of the country things had leveled off? And I think it had something to do with the policies that were going on in Milwaukee under Mike McGahn. That's part of it. Dane County was having these massive disparities in the early 1990s. Then you start getting the ongoing evolution of probation and parole, where people are on paper, and so then they're under intense supervision, and that makes them more likely to end up back in prison. Lots of forces.
And Pam, as we get ready to wrap up here, what do you see that could start to turn things around quickly? You say the incarceration rate for black men is on the decline, but what would we like to do to make things more effective in this state that you might see models of elsewhere?
So I'm more a numbers person and less good at the policies. So I can tell you that the big issue that has to be dealt with is all these people who are now on paper. They've been sent to prison. They're now stigmatized with having a prison record. They're now under almost permanent surveillance by the criminal justice system under probation or under parole. Well, it's not called parole anymore, but extended supervision. And those people are constantly at risk of reincarceration. And that's, a huge factor that could be affecting incarceration. I'm making this up fast, is the jail incarceration could be going up because of all these people being pulled in for probation parole holds. So lots of factors.
Pam, thanks so much for joining us today. That was Pam Oliver, professor of sociology at UW-Madison and an expert in racial disparities and criminal justice. And she joined us here in studio to talk about why the black incarceration rate in Wisconsin is so high, the highest in the nation, and what, if anything, can be done about it. Stay tuned. You're listening to Central Time.
Today is National Waffle Day, marking the first waffle iron patent back in 1869. This is one of those random days on the calendar, by the way, that we at Central Time can totally get behind.
That's right, Rob. You are a big waffling guy. I'm a big fan of waffles. I don't make them as often as I used to, but there's something just intrinsically happy about waffles, isn't there?
There is, and I don't make them as often as I intend to or want to, but I love getting out the waffle iron. And years ago on Central Time, one of our Food Fridays early on, we had the author of the book Will It Waffle talked about. He said, if you've got the waffle iron, don't just make waffles on it. There's all sorts. You can do veggies, zucchini, eggs on it. And I've made my, of course, I've talked about on the show, squash waffles, or as I call them, squaffles. And squash is about to be back in season, so I'm looking forward to that. They don't travel well, otherwise I'd bring some in to share.
So I have to ask you, are you a fan of the Belgian waffle? Those are the really thick grids with a lot of air space in between, or the classic waffle, which is a little fluffier
skinnier.
And chewier?
I will say yes. I am a fan of both. You give me waffles, I'm going to eat them.
If it's a waffle, you're going to eat it.
All right. And you can, by the way, we've got a link to the Will It Waffle page on the Central Time Facebook page. You can get some obscure waffle inspiration right there on the Central Time Facebook page.
Happy waffling. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.